Well, welcome back to Shattering Myths. We'd be remiss if we didn't provide a little editorial comment on the misleading nature of the Christian Mingle commercial. So, Scott, take it away.
Sometimes it feels like you'll never find the one God intended for you.
What you just said is one of the most insanely idiotic things I have ever heard. At no point in your rambling, incoherent response were you even close to anything that could be considered a rational thought. Everyone is now dumber for having listened to it.
And that is my conclusion every time I hear the Christian Mingle claims that that God is somehow involved with their software, and that that he is just ever ready to intervene and manipulate the software so that you, dear Christian, whom he does not know, will find another Christian whom he does not know for wedded bliss. It is moronic.
You mean he doesn't want me to be happy?
He wants you to be happy, and that's why he doesn't want you to be a Christian. There you go. We were concluding our review yesterday of the third statement that Yahweh etched on the first of the two tablets. 77 Hebrew words on the first tablet, 77 words on the second tablet. The first tablet contains three sweeping statements that that go to great lengths to define the terms and conditions of the covenant. It explains what we ought to do to engage in the covenant. They tell us about Yahweh's nature, his purpose, his role in our lives, what he encourages us to do and what he discourages. He encourages us to know him by name, to recognize that Yahweh alone is God, that he himself, Yahweh, is our Savior, that he is saving us from the crucible of human religious and political oppression, that if we wish to be religious, that we will not exist in his presence. He tells us that that he is wholly opposed to all forms of religious and political idolatry, that the very thing that the Pope was celebrating in Brazil is the thing that he discourages and says, I hate. And he hates it, and he expresses that through jealousy by saying that it is by being religious and political that you harm your own children, that you corrupt your own children, and that he takes offense to that. And that the only way that thousands will receive his mercy is to walk to him in love and to observe the terms and conditions of his covenant. He then has a overall statement that speaks to the worst of human behavior. This is the very essence of religion and politics. It is a condemnation of the President of the United States' most recent address on the economy, as well as the statements made by the Pope in Brazil. This is what he etched in stone. You should never deceive or delude. You should never deploy clever tricks to enrich oneself by indebting others. And never beguile people, causing them to miss the way. You should never lift up or bear. You should never actually support or advance, nor forgive or tolerate. Promoting yourself through the name and reputation of Yahweh, your God. Advancing worthless and lifeless deception. Deploying that which advances devastating dishonesty, leading to the nullifications of one's existence. For indeed, Yahweh will never forgive nor leave unpunished, will not purify nor pardon, acquit nor free from guilt, exempt from judgment or sentence or even release those who, in accordance with that which they associate, consistently deceive, actually beguile, and habitually delude in association with his name, to promote and affect vain and ineffectual lies, which lead to lifelessness and destruction. Showing that they did not get the message, virtually every translation found in a corruption itself called the Holy Bible. Holy is from the pagan notion of Helios and the sun god of the Teutonic religions. And Bible is from Biblia, the name of the pagan goddess in Egypt. They changed this to say, you shall not take the name of thy Lord, thy God, in vain. Completely twisting it, deceiving and deluding through the name and reputation of Yahweh. It's little wonder that so few people understand the truth. It's little wonder that only thousands amongst billions walk to Yahweh in love. They don't know who he is. How are you going to know who he is when something that he himself etched in stone, using his own name, writing his own name twice in the specific statement, is corrupted, replacing his name with Satan's title? Perverting the meaning of every word used in the statement. How is it that anyone's going to walk to Yahweh in love, or is going to focus on closely examining or carefully considering the terms and conditions of his covenant when his testimony is corrupted, as it is in every English Bible?
Doesn't he say that names are pretty important? Doesn't he kind of tell you to hold his name in a pretty high regard?
Well, you could, if you wish to focus on every aspect of this particular statement, you could distill it down to a single concept. The corrupting and negating his name is unforgivable. This particular statement can be condensed to that concept, that corrupting and negating his name. Now, if you replace his name 7,000 times and replace it with the Lord, Satan's title, you have negated it, haven't you?
Very much so.
Yeah. And so he right here said, negating his name, having his name be for naught, beguiling people relative to his name, which would be changing his name to Satan's title, Lord, is an unforgivable sin. Which means that every Bible publisher, every Bible translator is guilty of this unforgivable sin. Every minister, every pastor, every pope, every priest who has errantly cited this statement, replacing Yahweh's name, making it for naught with the Satan's title, has committed an unforgivable sin. And that unforgivable sin only is unforgivable in the imperfect, the continuation of doing so. But since none of them have corrected the record and said, you know, we have this wrong, we have misstated what God stated regarding his name, this very statement that he etched in stone says that we ought not do what we have done. The moment they do that, they're no longer guilty of habitual, ongoing, and continuous negation of his name. But none of them have changed. Yes, Yahweh tells us that salvation is only in his name. That if you don't know him as he is by name, then you will never enter his presence. I mean, that is the first statement that he etched in stone. I am Yahweh your God. I am your Savior. I am the one who led you away from the crucible of religious and political oppression. You will not exist with any other God in my presence. You know, a God by any other name, he actually says, if my name is Yahweh, that is the way I wish to be memorialized and remembered. God by any other name is a false God. So it's God's position on this is extraordinarily clear. Those who say it doesn't matter what you call God are stating a religious point of view that is wholly contrary to God's point of view. God hates Jesus. That's just the truth. God hates Jesus. God damns religion. That's the truth. If you care about God's perspective, Yahweh hates the name Jesus. He despises religion. If you're going to know him, you need to disassociate yourself from Jesus Christ, from Christianity, from Allah, and from all manner of human corruptions and lifeless deceptions. That is the first step to participating in the covenant. Until you walk away from Babel, from Babylon, from corruption, you cannot walk to God or with God. Now, regardless of how you pronounce or translate the words that Yahweh inscribed, God, Yahweh, himself says that he will not forgive those who deceive others, especially when doing so by negating his name and reputation. And that means that all of the world's religious leaders and founding fathers, from Rabbi Akiva to the Apostle Paul to General Constantine and the Prophet Muhammad, will all be spending time together with the spirit that they served, Hasatan. Although I don't suspect they will enjoy it very much. There is only one thing Yahweh hates more than deadly and beguiling religious and political deceptions, and that is when they are promoted by negating the value of his name by people who claim to be speaking for him. And that known, when it comes to judgment, you don't want to be in the same line as religious clerics. All of those morons in Brazil, hundreds of thousands who are flocking towards this pope, who is the epitome of evil on earth, don't join that line. It's a very dangerous place for you to be. You don't want to be in the same line when it comes to judgment as religious clerics, as popes, priests, pastors, monks, rabbis, or imams. And there's a parallel line of presidents and kings, generals, politicians, and military leaders. You don't want to be in that line either. In fact, if you are going to be judged, you are in trouble. So that you know, since every verb was presented in the imperfect, which speaks of that which is continuous and ongoing, in the shadow of the negation lo provides, rather than simply saying you should not, it is far more accurate to say you should never. Or, to be precisely accurate, you should not continuously. You should not make a habit of, which the call stem further modifies to telling us that God's serious here. This requires a literal interpretation, and there is a relationship between those who do these things and their ultimate fate. I am Yada. This is Shattering Myths. Back in a moment. Oh, it's truly amazing. But during the break, I was reading an email that was sent by a friend who said that Crayola is now promoting the use of crayons to celebrate Ramadan and other Islamic festivals and ideas. And sure enough, if you go to the Crayola.com site and you type in either Ramadan or Islam, and there you have it. It is truly amazing that we have stooped to the level of making crayons to celebrate the most vicious, the most deplorable, the most destructive dogma that man has ever conceived. We have Sharon, who is calling in from Colorado, has a question about where we go. Hello, Sharon. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. First, I want to thank you for speaking the truth out politics and religion. And then I have the question. From the Sunday Keepers, I always heard you go to heaven, and then we went Messianic, and they said you inherit the earth, and now we've pulled out of everything, and I'm wondering what you had to say.
Yeah, good. The Messianic movement typically blends rabbinic Judaism with Pauline Christianity, so it's kind of a blend of both. And I'm not sure that, in fact, I'm quite sure that using two counterfeits and two corruptions in the brew is no better than using one poison in the brew. So I'm glad that you have left both. In fact, it's interesting that there is no place in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms where Mashiach, which is the Hebrew pronunciation, is used as a title. Never once. The two places in Daniel where prophetically it speaks of the arrival, the definite article is not used, and Mashiach is actually used as an adjective. It is an adjective describing the nature of the messenger and of the message. The message is set apart and dedicated to serve is what Mashiach means. So set apart and dedicated to serve, and it's modifying the term messenger. It's not used as a title. So this whole concept of celebrating Mashiach and being Messianic is a corruption of Yahweh's teaching. It's not a significant aspect of his Torah. I know that's not your your question, but it just strikes me that it's so odd that people focus on things like Christianity, where people label themselves Christians based upon a corrupted Greek supposed even translation of the title Mashiach, when Mashiach is never used as a title, and Christian from Christo actually means drugged and whitewashed. But people will identify with these corrupt terms and say, "Well, that's me. I'm defined by that." Yahweh tells us that we are empowered and enriched by him, and that we become very much like he became upon Bokorim, as spiritual individuals. And that means that when we live with him in his home in heaven throughout eternity, that we will be a spiritual individual, not a physical being, but as an energy-based spirit, as light, it is always possible to dim ourselves down, if you will, and to take on physical form, because energy and matter are the same thing. It's just that matter is a diminished form of energy. So we can dial ourselves down and take on physical form when it suits our interest. Now, your question was relative to the earth. The answer is yes to both. There is a thousand-year period called the Millennial Shabbat. It's a thousand-year celebration of Sukkah, which is the seventh step that we walk to God, that will begin 5 days after Yahweh returns, which will be on Yom Kippurim in year 6000 Yah on our pagan calendars. It's October 2nd at 6:22 p.m. Jerusalem time when the sun begins to set in Jerusalem. In 2033, 5 days after that, after Yahweh has the opportunity to cleanse the earth of all religion and religious artifacts and politics and all of the corruption and return it the earth back to the conditions found at the Garden of Eden, we will celebrate a 1,000-year time living on this earth, an earth returned to the conditions of Garden of Eden, with Yahweh. Now, that time, though, is there's some things, there are interesting insights relative to that time and who participates in that, and what happens to those of us who spend the time because we have been harvested through Teruah prior to that event. And so let's chat about it a little bit more when Shattering Mist returns. Stay with us, Sharon. Welcome back to Shattering Mist. We're talking with Sharon, calling in from Colorado, speaking. The question was really, do we, and by we, it would be the children of the covenant, those who have accepted the five terms and conditions of the covenant, have come to know Yahweh, have walked to him in love, following the path that he has provided, and embraced those terms and conditions of the covenant and received its benefits. The covenant's children, prior to the beginning of what's called the time of Jacob's troubles, or the tribulation that lasts 7 years here on earth, which begins in the fall of 2026, that sometime prior to that, and it could be in the fall of 2026 or any year between now and then on Teruah, which is the first day of the seventh month on Yahweh's calendar, he is going to call us home. Now, we are going to be gathered by him spiritually, not physically. So we know that prior to this time that that the tribulation then concludes and Yahweh returns on the day of reconciliations, that we are off doing our thing. We have the opportunity to go explore the universe, you know, the distances of the universe, which have put almost all of it beyond our reach. I mean, 99.999999% of it beyond our reach now. As a form of light, as spiritual energy, we're going to be able to explore the existing universe, and we'll be able to do so for a minimum of 7 years, and it could be more depending on when this Teruah harvest occurs. Although, even that seems, well, that might not seem like a long period of time. As light, time becomes irrelevant to us. So 7 years can seem like an eternity.
So you're saying that basically, I hate to use the word rapture, that the believers, the true believers, are taken out for the tribulation.
Yeah, the rapture is Paul's terms. It's based upon harpazo in the Greek. It's a violent snatching away. Yahusha uses the same word in association with the wolf in sheep's clothing that is when he's describing Paul and the damage that Paul does on so many. So the harvest is the Greek word that Yahusha is translated saying, he did not use this term, but the word that he's translated saying is paralambano for the event. But he's speaking of the Teruah harvest. Teruah is the fifth of seven of his invitations to meet. And on that particular invitation, some Teruah between now and 2033, not believers, because belief is meaningless to Yahweh, but to those who have acted upon the terms and conditions of the covenant, will be removed from this planet. Our souls will be harvested by Yahweh. And during the time then between then and the time that Yahweh returns physically to Earth, this time as light, we will be out exploring the universe, because he specifically says that when he returns, we are called from the four corners of the universe to join him. So we join him after having spent anywhere from seven to could be as many almost 20 years visiting exploring the universe. Now, what follows, Yom Kippurim, the Day of Reconciliations when he returns, is all about Yahweh honoring the promises that he made in the covenant to Abraham, to Yishak, and to Jacob. He is reconciling his relationship with Yisrael and with Yehudim. The vast majority of the individuals who populate the millennial Shabbat, therefore inheriting the earth, are racial Jews. And they will be the largest in number. They are they're given back their the territory in Yisrael itself that Yahweh originally gave to them. And they occupy Yisrael in this reclaimed, reconditioned earth. And Yahweh himself will reside in Jerusalem. And so it's primarily for him honoring the promise that he made in the covenant to Abraham, to Yitzhak, and to Jacob. Now, that what we really don't know for certain, and there's some question, as to whether or not the children of the covenant that were called back, not just to see Yahusha's and Yahweh's return, but also to govern the earth, because the people who will live on the earth during that 1,000 years are mortals. Are we called back to govern those mortals because we've got the Torah now written inside of us and we're able to govern based upon the Torah and guide based upon the Torah and teach based upon the Torah? Or are the children of Yisrael who accepted Yahweh and embraced the covenant upon his return, are they the ones that are guiding leading and teaching the inhabitants of the millennial Shabbat? And I don't really know the answer to that. God's not, he speaks of the leadership and he speaks of that time. But, I suspect if you are a racial Yehudim that you will be here in a role that will be ascribed to you by Yahweh. And if you are adopted, you'll probably get to spend that 1,000 years out enjoying the existing universe. Because at the end of that time, at the end of that 1,000 years, the universe as we know it is destroyed. And God has to do that because as spiritual energy, we would be able to maneuver in time, and going back in time, we would be able to witness the things that we and others have done that were so painful and hurtful. And so the only way that God can create a universe for us to explore for all eternity and to enjoy one another in is to create a new one. And so the earth as we know it will cease to exist, and a new universe is going to be and a new spiritual realm are going to be conceived after that 1,000-year period.
Sounds pretty awesome.
Pretty awesome. Yeah, I want to be there. It'd be very much like being an eyewitness to the creation of this universe, and to be able to have been an eyewitness to it without the constraints of being stuck in time. Because, you know, if you were stuck in time as a physical being, if you were to watch this the creation of this universe, it would take place over, you know, 15 billion years, and it'd get a little worrisome after a while. But as a spiritual being, we're going to be able to witness the creation of the universe and its full evolution from its genesis as if all of that was taking place right before our eyes in an instant. Yeah, it'd be very exciting stuff.
I have one more question.
Sure.
Well, kind of two, but I'll just say them and then I can actually listen online or whatever. But tassels have always, you know, the tzitzit have always been a big deal, and I was wondering what you thought about that. And I also have...
What has been a big deal?
The tassels, the tzitzit.
Okay. That's what I thought you were talking about, the tzitzit, yes. Yeah, they are in terms of... they're an outward expression of God being one. There's one blue thread in the white tassel, and the one blue thread speaks of one God, one path to God. The blue is indicative of being with Him spiritually in heaven, because it mirrors the color of the sky, and so it is, and it's on a white field. You know, the Torah purifies us and provides this lone path to God, and that's the symbolism of the tzitzit. Of the tassel, and I have expressed this many times, and certainly the possibility that I'm wrong here, but I'm in the Dode camp and perspective on how we are to observe the instructions like this in the Torah. Dode, who has been renamed as David, wrote the 119 Psalms expressly to teach us through 176 verses by going alphabetically through the 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet and explaining each of those letters' contribution to us properly observing the Torah. Never speaks of any rule. Never once mentions anything that we need to do other than the process of closely examining, carefully considering, coming to know, coming to understand, based upon that understanding, properly responding to the three aspects of the Torah that are important, which are its prescriptions for living that cut us into the relationship with Yahweh, Yahweh's means to reconcile us and resolve disputes, which would be the seven-step path that He has provided to His home, and the terms and conditions of the covenant. He says, focus on that, come to understand them, and then you, like me, are guaranteed entrance into heaven. Just come carrying the Torah. And so my perspective on the tzitzit is understand what it represents. Why is it woven into a white field? Why is there one blue stripe? I shared with you as I understand it. Appreciate what that communicates, and how you would look at this and wear this as a symbol of what God is teaching us, and then that's better than wearing it.
Well, we haven't gone, you know, worn them because we had trouble. I mean, when we were in Israel, some of the people wore them down to their ankles, while others, you know, wore them in different ways.
And a matter of fact, 100% of those that are wearing them don't know Yahweh. They aren't saved by Him. They don't know him. They're religious. They're rabbinical. They're fixated on the doing as opposed to the understanding. And when you're fixated on the doing rather than the understanding, then you've missed the point of the Torah entirely. So I can tell you, I don't wear one. My view is that the Torah is teaching. That's why the word means teaching. It's guidance and direction from God that tells us how we get to know Him, so that we can come to respect Him, ultimately love Him, and so that we can approach Him through the means that He has provided and become a member of His family. I see it all exists for that singular purpose.
May I ask one more question?
Sure, go ahead. Go ahead.
I have an 18-year-old daughter. We just finished homeschooling, and she's graduated. And one of her big concerns is she will never find a spouse who believes like we do.
Yeah. Yeah, I would use the term who knows and understands what we know and understand, or who knows Yahweh as we know Him and understands what Yahweh is offering us. I know that since you, like myself, have come out of religion and literally come out of religion, there is a legacy of religion that still clings to us, and it takes time to disgorge it. I have found that even though I spend so much of every day focused on trying to learn more from Yahweh, that I still have it too. And so I'm not being critical when I say we shouldn't be using the term belief, but belief really is a religious term. It is a Christian term. Belief is the absence of knowing. If you know, you don't need to believe. If you understand, you don't need to have faith. God is all about giving us the ability to know and understand. We'll address that question, Sharon, when Shattering Myths returns after the break.
I'm going to go ahead and hang up.
Hello, welcome back to Shattering Myths. I wanted to answer Sharon's question the best I could, and then we have Glenn on the line, and he has a question as well. Sharon, the one thing we know is that that very few people come to accept the terms and conditions of the covenant. Very few people walk to God in love along the path that He has provided. He has said that there are thousands. And if you look at thousands amongst the billions of people that are alive today, then you would expect very few candidates for a son or daughter to find that holds these same truths, that has accepted Yahweh as He is and has embraced the covenant. So the son or daughter who comes to you and says, you know, based upon what we have learned, it is unlikely that I will find a marriage partner who knows and Yahweh as we do and who has embraced the covenant as we do. That is true. Now, I have youngest son is a member of Yahweh's covenant family. He knows Yahweh as we do. We talk about our relationship with Yah often. He is dating and not married. And he has acknowledged that the likelihood of him finding someone who has come to this same conclusion, who has embraced Yahweh, is nil. But what he attempts to do is to, in any dating relationship that becomes somewhat serious, is to steer away from those who are devoutly religious, and in particular to try to reach out to agnostics who are at least open, and with the understanding that that there is a reasonable chance, it's probably one chance in two, three, or four, that an agnostic presented the truth will embrace it. And so particularly in the confines of a loving relationship. So I don't think it's as remote as your daughter, I don't know if it was a daughter or son, but I think a daughter might suspect, because of this opportunity to in a dating relationship with an agnostic be able to explain God's truth, which typically resonates with open-minded agnostics. Hello, Glenn. I understand you have a question on what Yahweh is saving us from.
Well, yeah, before I do that, a chance in two, three, or four that an agnostic, you actually think that 25% of agnostics presented with a message would embrace it?
Yeah, I do. But I quantified that a bit. I said in a loving relationship. So if you're with an agnostic and you have a very close, loving, and trusting relationship with that agnostic, and you meticulously explain Yahweh's covenant and his approach and his disdain for religion, that as I receive emails from thousands of people around the world who talk about those that are closest to them either coming to or rejecting Yahweh's Torah teaching, what I found is that there is a decidedly significant percentage of agnostics who are engaged in loving relationships with those who have formerly been agnostics and have come to know the truth, and them embracing it. So, it's strictly anecdotal based upon the thousands of emails that I've received. But in the right set of circumstances, agnostics exposed to the truth who have a reason to care about the truth because they're engaged in a relationship with someone who knows it, there's the percentage of success is pretty high.
That's anecdotal, A-N-E-C-D-O-T-A-L. Anecdotal. My original question was, in terms of basically emphasis, it seems to me, I keep hearing you talk about God saving people from politics and religion, whereas it seems to me the primary emphasis of Yahweh's salvation is on the salvation from sin and its effects. I mean, even in the first Passover, you have the shed blood of the lamb put on the doorposts and lintels. It's those who are, saved by blood covenant with Yahweh, the judgment passes over them. So, it seems rarely that the emphasis of what God saves from is not merely the crucible of the Egyptians or politics or religion, but our own sin and its effect.
Well, let's talk about that.
It seems like that's to be the emphasis.
Yahweh, in the first statement that he etched in stones, didn't say that he saved us from sin. He specifically talked about saving us from the crucible of Egypt, which he explains to be religion and politics. But beyond that, it's cause and effect. The source of sin and the terms that God uses for sin are missing the way and perversion and corruption. So the very terms that he uses to describe the effect speak of the cause. So they're really one and the same. We'll return to Shattering Myths this time tomorrow. May God bless you all.